Okay, thank you. First of all, I apologize if this presentation is not going to be very lively, but this is a difficult day for any Italians after yesterday's game. And anyway, I'll try to do my best. So this is work in collaboration with Alessandro Bonanno and Etienne Racine, which we did last year at the University of Maryland. So first of all, why do we need, and sorry, it's about a new effective one-body model for spinning black hole binaries. So first of all, why do we need a new effective one-body model for spinning black hole binaries? Why do we need an effective one-body model in the first place? The reason is, as all of you know, that the two-body problem in full GR is a very difficult problem. There are no analytical solutions, and later you have to resort to numerical simulations, but even numerical simulations were remained an open problem for many years until a series of breakthroughs in 2006 and 2005 allowed the numerical relativity groups to produce waveforms which contained both the spiral as well as the merger and ring down. But still today, these simulations are very time expensive because it can take weeks or days on a supercomputer to produce a single black hole binary. So if you really want to do gravitational wave astronomy using binary black holes, so you need something which is faster than that, and then you have to resort to analytical relativity models, and the effective one-body model is one of these models. So we try to give you a very brief introduction, a crash course on the EOB model. So the idea is very simple indeed. The idea is to map a two-body problem into a test particle problem. So on the one hand, we have a comparable mass binary, which we can simulate only with numerical relativity. And on the other hand, we have an extreme mass ratio in spiral, if you want, a test particle moving in a background space-time. So this is, of course, much easier and faster to simulate because you only need to solve all the E's, whereas this takes weeks. And you can wonder why such a mapping should be possible in the first place. And the reason is, of course, this mapping is exact in Newtonian theory because you can always map a comparable mass binary into an extreme mass ratio binary. That is, you can map the comparable mass problem into the problem of a test particle having mass equals to the reduced mass of the system, orbiting around a bigger body having mass equals to the total mass of the system. This is Newtonian mechanics, and that's exact. And at least approximately, this mapping also holds in quantum theory, or at least in QED. Because if you calculate the energy levels of positronium, which is a system composed of an electron and a positron, that is, it's a comparable mass system, it turns out that the energy levels of positronium are mapped into the energy levels of hydrogen by means of this simple relation, where EH are the energy levels of hydrogen and EPOS are the energy levels of positronium. This was an old result derived in the 70s. But it turns out that indeed you can map a comparable mass binary, electron and anti-electron, into an extreme mass ratio system because hydrogen is an extreme mass ratio system. And it turns out that, and this was shown by Bonanno and Damour in 2001, that this mapping also holds in post-Newtonian theory. And at least for non-spinning black hole binaries, which is the case they considered in 2001. So what they did was to consider the conservative part of the dynamics of non-spinning black hole binaries. So they wrote down the Hamiltonian describing the conservative part of the dynamics, the so-called ADM Hamiltonian. They did some canonical transformation, but that's a minor point. And they called this the post-Newtonian expanded real Hamiltonian because that's the problem that you want to reproduce. That's a comparable mass binary. And then they consider also an effective picture in which you have a particle which has a mass equals to the reduced mass of the system orbiting around a sparse black hole having mass equals to the total mass of the system. And this is inspired by, of course, Newtonian gravity. But they also introduced some modification of the Schwarzschild geometry. And it turns out that if you choose the deformations of the Schwarzschild geometry in a suitable way, the mapping between the Hamiltonian describing this effective system is linked to the Hamiltonian describing the real problem by a relation which is exactly the same as in the case of hydrogen and positronium. So this is very nice. And it holds, of course, it holds up to a certain post-Newtonian order because the Post-Newtonian Hamiltonian is only known up to 3PN order. On the other hand, the effective Hamiltonian can be calculated formally at any order because it's simply the Hamiltonian of a test particle in a curved space-time. So in principle, what you can do is to invert this relation and express H real in terms of H effective. And what you get is this simple formula, which allows you to calculate H real once in terms of H effective. And because H effective is known at any post-Newtonian order, indeed it's not, in order to write H effective, you don't need post-Newtonian theory, as I will show explicitly in a while. This H real, which you get, coincides with the original post-Newtonian expanded H real through 3PN order, but it can also be calculated up to an arbitrary post-Newtonian order. So this is called, at least that's, Bonan Damour called it resummed real Hamiltonian or EOB Hamiltonian. And it turns out that if you supplement this Hamiltonian, which describes the conservative part of the dynamics, with a model for the fluxes about which Nico Yunes talked in his seminar 2 days ago, and if you also make up a recipe to attach quasi-normal modes and describe the ring down of the system, turns out that this Hamiltonian can reproduce very well the results of numerical relativity simulations. So the idea is to do something similar for the case of spinning black hole binaries, because of course we know that black holes, real black holes, have spins. So in principle, one can write down the ADM Hamiltonian describing the conservative part of the dynamics in the case of spinning black holes, and you can try to map this real problem into the problem of a particle having mass equals to the reduced mass of the system and a certain spin orbiting around a Kerr black hole having mass equals to the total mass of the system and a suitable spin. And you can hope that somehow choosing the spins of the effective particle and of the effective Kerr black hole, and by introducing somehow with the formation of the Kerr geometry, you can hope that the Hamiltonian describing this effective system is linked to the post-Newtonian expanded Hamiltonian by a relation of this kind. This is not assured. It depends on, you can hope that this happens if you choose the deformation of the metric properly and the spins properly. And then in principle, you can dream of inverting this relation and express H real in terms of H effective, and then you would get a resummed real Hamiltonian, which would be in agreement with the original post-Newtonian expanded Hamiltonian through 3PN order, and it would also be defined for any arbitrary post-Newtonian order, and you can hope that, of course, you can reproduce NR data for spinning black holes. The problem with this blueprint is that before our work, nobody knew how to write down the Hamiltonian describing a spinning test particle in a generic curved space-time, so we first had to solve this problem, to find the Hamiltonian describing a spinning test particle motion in a curved space-time. Actually, there had been some work on this, on effective one-body models for spinning black hole binaries before ours, and that was due to Damour, Janowski, and Schaefer in 2008. And because they didn't know what the effective Hamiltonian looked like, they tried to guess it, and they tried to introduce a phenomenological link between the spin of the particle and the curvature of the background. However, it turns out that their guess was good, but not so good, because they recovered the test particle limit only approximately. And because of this, so their Hamiltonian did not give the so-called Matheson-Proprietary-Pirani equations, which are the equations describing a spinning test particle, the motion of a spinning test particle. And so because of this original sin, basically their Hamiltonian had a number of problems when comparing to NR data, because it turns out that at high post-Newtonian orders, their Hamiltonian didn't allow an innermost stable circular orbit to exist in the case in which the spins are aligned with the orbital angular momentum. And it turns out that this is very bad news when you try to reproduce NR data, and because you need an effective ISCO when you compare it to NR data. And although in some regions of parameter space this ISCO existed, the dependence of the ISCO on the spins and on the other parameters of the system was not monotonic, was not regular. So this Hamiltonian didn't work very well. And also, again, because the test particle limit was broken, in their model, they did not have any natural way of attaching the quasi-normal modes and describe the ring down of the remnant black hole, and they had to resort to an ad hoc matching procedure. So we want to do better than this, and the first thing that we want to do is to calculate what the Hamiltonian for a spinning test particle in curved space-time is. And to do so, we follow the same route that had been that people follow in the case of a non-spinning test particle. In the non-spinning test particle, you start from the equations of motion, which are given by the geodesics equations. You write down an action for geodetic motion, and this is simply given by minus m integral over d tau, where tau is the proper time. This is something which one can find in textbooks and can also be guessed on dimensional grounds if you want. And then one introduces a time slicing, exploits the definition of the Lagrangian of the action as the integral of the Lagrangian over time, and extracts an expression for the Lagrangian describing the motion of a non-spinning particle, and you get this closed form, which is which you can calculate once you know the metric of the space-time. And then what you do is to perform a Lejeune transformation and define, as usual, the moment as the derivatives of the Lagrangian with respect to the velocities, and then you write the Hamiltonian. And it turns out that the Hamiltonian is very simple, and it's given by this closed form, which can be calculated once you know the metric of the space-time. And of course, in the flat space-time case, you simply get the energy of the particle in special relativity. So we want to do something like this in the case of a spinning particle. The problem is that for a spinning particle, the equations of motion are much more complicated because they're not given, of course, by the geodesics equation, but they are given by the so-called Matheson-Papapetru-Pirani equations, which feature an equation for the for acceleration. And this equation, instead of having zero on the right-hand side, as you would have in the case of geodetic motion, they feature a coupling between the spin tensor, which describes the curvature of the background, and, a Riemann tensor, and a spin tensor, which describes the spin of the particle. And this tensor is anti-symmetric, and it has two indices. And then, of course, you have a precession equation, which prescribes how the spin evolves along the world line. And there is one strange thing about this equation. As I said, the spin tensor has two indices, and it's anti-symmetric. So it has 6 degrees of freedom rather than 3, which is what you would expect, of course, for the spin. And this makes, among other things, the system underdetermined. Because if you count the number of equations here, you will count 10 of them. And the number of variables will be instead 13, right, because of this of these 3 extra degrees of freedom for the spin. So what people do is to impose a so-called spin supplementary condition. That is, you impose that the spin tensor, you want to get rid of these 3 extra degrees of freedom for the spin. So what you have to do is to impose a spin supplementary condition. You impose that the spin tensor contracted with some time-like vector equals 0. And this kills 3 degrees of freedom for the spin, closes the system. And it also has a very nice physical meaning, because when I said that the Matheson-Papapetru-Pirani equations describe a spinning particle, I said something which made no sense, because in general relativity, a spinning particle must have a finite size, because if you have a spinning particle and you send the size to 0 and you shrink it while keeping the spin constant, at some point you will have superluminal motion inside the particle. So you have to specify which point you're following inside the body. And the choice of the point which you follow inside the body is given by this spin supplementary condition. So by imposing this condition, you'll pick up a particular point inside the body. And this, of course, closes the system, because the system initially was not was underdetermined, right, because you hadn't decided which point you wanted to follow inside the body. So the equations are much more complicated than in the case of geodetic motion, and so the procedure to get the Hamiltonian is much more complicated, and I don't have time to enter into the details, so I tried to sum up a sketch of the derivation in just one slide, although it would take much more time to go through the details. So we have the equations of motion. We want to write down first an action which gives those equations of motion. And fortunately, that action had already been derived in the past, actually in the 70s in the flat space-time case, and more recently by Porter in 2006 in the curved space-time case. We then introduce a time slicing, and exploiting the definition of the action as the integral of the Lagrangian over time, we extract a Lagrangian which still has a dependence on the spin tensor, so it still has 6 degrees of freedom. So for this reason, I call it unconstrained Lagrangian, because we still have to get rid of these 3 spurious degrees of freedom. Then we perform a Legendre transformation and derive the unconstrained Hamiltonian, which will still have 6 degrees of freedom for the spin, and the 6 degrees of freedom for the momenta conjugate to the spin. So we are now in a worse situation, if you want, because we have 6 spurious degrees of freedom. But now we kill those degrees of freedom by imposing a spin supplementary condition and another set of auxiliary constraints, because we want to kill 3 degrees of freedom for the spin and 3 degrees of freedom for the momenta conjugate to the spin. And we impose these constraints directly in phase space using a technique called Dirac brackets technique, which is used in QFT. And it turns out that if we choose the constraints that we impose properly, the Dirac brackets algebra is canonical. And maybe it's not clear to you what this means. The bottom line is that if we choose the constraints properly, the Hamilton equations take the usual form x dot equals dh over dp, p dot equals minus dh over dp. But this only if you choose the constraints properly, and this is what we did indeed. And so if we choose the constraints in this way, your Hamiltonian has the usual meaning, because you can write the Hamilton equation have the usual meaning. So after doing all of this, we came up with an expression for the Hamiltonian describing the motion of a spinning test particle in a generic curved space-time. And actually, this Hamiltonian is valid at linear order in the particle spin, because the Matheson Papavetrou-Pirani equations are valid at linear order in the particle spin. So of course, if we start with something which has a remainder of order s squared, the final result will have a remainder of order s squared too. At any rate, this Hamiltonian comprises of a first part, which is the Hamiltonian for a non-spinning test particle, which is what I had given you a few slides ago, plus a coupling between the spin of the particle and the curvature of the background, which is given by this expression in round brackets. So you can calculate this Hamiltonian once you specify the metric of the background space-time, and also there is also another gauge degrees of freedom which you have to specify, but it turns out that this basically you have to specify a reference tetrad field in each point of the space-time. But it turns out that this is a gauge degree of freedom, because the Hamiltonian that you get is simply, of course, if you choose this reference tetrad field in different ways, you get a Hamiltonian which changes. But these Hamiltonians are linked by a canonical transformation. And I also have a physical meaning for this reference tetrad field, which is this reference tetrad field basically describes the reference frame with respect to which you measure the components of the spin. Anyway, I'm running out of time, so I think let me finish and say that using this Hamiltonian for the spinning test particle, we were able to implement rigorously the recipe which I gave in my initial slides. So we were able to build an effective one-body model for a spinning black hole binaries which works and which does not suffer of the shortcomings of the previous models. So we have the correct test particle limit, basically by construction. And right because of this, we always have an ISCO when the spins are aligned with the orbital angular momentum. The dependence of the ISCO position on the, or ISCO frequency on the parameters of the system looks sensible. And also we have, it turns out that we have a very nice way, a natural way of attaching the quasi-normal modes and describe the ring down. And you can hear more about this in the talk which is coming on right after mine. And let me say that we can also, after calibrating this model, we can also reproduce the self-force results for the ISCO shift calculated by Barak and Sago. So I skip this and go to the conclusions. So basically, we as a first part of this work, we derived the Hamiltonian describing the motion of a spinning test particle in a generic curved space-time, and this comes 60 years after the equations of motions were written, so we're pretty proud of this. Using this Hamiltonian, we could derive a new effective one-body model for spinning black hole binaries, which works, or at least it seems to work. At least it doesn't suffer from obvious shortcomings. And of course, we need to calibrate this against the numerical relativity results or self-force results. As far as the self-force results, we're basically done because there are not many results, but we're currently calibrating